Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the program. Between now and nine, getting big business to pay for nature restoration, the greatest threat to the future of the GAA, and leaning on Gates, the much-anticipated follow-up to Standing in Gaps, Seamus O'Rourke on his awkward years. Good morning, how are you? Wherever that nip in the air came from, it's gone. It is a muggy one out there this morning. We have a really, really great programme lined up for you today. I want to begin with the single question that comes up on this programme time and time again. Farmers and landowners pretty much all always say something like, I'd like to do more for nature, but I'd also like to be paid for my time when I do it. How do I get paid for all the things that everyone wants to see being done, but it falls to me to do? So, how do farmers get paid for hedgerows that eat into their fields? How do they get paid for putting in something nice but non-essential like a pond? How do they get paid for using less pesticides and herbicides when doing that obviously reduces their yields? This morning we are going to take a stab at that question. I'm joined by Dr. Brendan Dunford, who you will have heard on here before talking about the incredibly successful Burren Life programme, which paid farmers for environmental conservation. Good morning, Dr. Dunford, how are you?
Good morning, Philip. Good to talk to you.
You are one of a number of people now taking this principle onto a national stage, the principle of Burren Life, with an initiative that is to be launched next month called ReFarm. If you explain the name ReFarm, it might be a good way to explain the idea.
Yeah, what's in a name? I suppose my background is obviously in nature conservation, and I suppose when you're talking about nature conservation in an Irish context, you're really talking about farming, because farmers own and manage so much of the land. But I think from the farmer's perspective, a lot of the terms being used, like rewilding and rewetting and things like that, aren't, you know, as good as those terms are and as important as they are. They tend to maybe frighten farmers a little bit, or maybe intimidate them, or maybe make them think, well, what role do I have here? So I think ReFarm is a more inclusive, softer term, and it's also more middle ground between the extremes of land abandonment and factory farming, I suppose. It's right there in the middle, and that's where we need to be inclusive.
Rewilding is a term that means about 14 or 15 different things. What does ReFarm mean?
I think, to me, it means reimagining our relationship with the land and reimagining as a society what we feel the role of farmers is. So I think the essence of this project, Philip, is about finance. It's about figuring out where we're going to pay for these needs that nature has at the moment, at the time of crisis. So I think when we look at farmers, we tend to think of them as food producers, but really they're much more than that. They are, when it's done properly, they're stewards and custodians of the landscape. They're the ones who can drive the restoration of biodiversity and so on. And I think we need companies who do have finance and will have obligations to report on biodiversity in the future. We need them to see farmers as a resource on the ground who can help them to deliver for their needs for improving biodiversity.
And this is an auspicious moment at which to do that, because across Europe now there are thousands and thousands of companies and big businesses that are, as you say, increasingly required by law to move their operations onto a more sustainable footing. How do regulations governing manufacturing and industry present an opportunity for farming?
Well, I think the big one coming is the corporate sustainability reporting directive, through which companies will have to disclose their, you know, concrete biodiversity targets and action plans. And, you know, I do think they're going to be seeking partners to do that. And I think the logical partner to me is the farmer on the ground. Just as you described, Philip, I meet farmers all the time who want to put in more hedgerows, to create ponds. If they had a little bit of advice and financial support, they would do that. So I think there's a perfect marriage in prospect here between those companies who need to do things and farmers who are willing to do them. And I do think, like, there's lots of dimensions to this, not just the financial one. I do think it's also a way of, you know, creating a sense of purpose and vision around farming, which could be attractive to a new generation of farmers, because after all, succession has become a huge issue now. And I know young people are really driven by a sense of purpose, and this could be part of that sense of purpose, that they're farming not just for quality food, nutrient-dense food, but also for nature and getting paid for it.
We'll get into the nuts and bolts of how that's going to be done in a minute. But earlier on this week, I travelled to a farm in Kildare to hear from somebody who has for the last 10 years been transitioning from an intensive tillage operation to something with a much lighter footprint that improves on soil quality, pollinator numbers, water quality and so on. Andrew Bergen was that busy on the day that I visited that I had to chat to him while he was working in the tractor about what it was that he thought would incentivise others to follow his example.
We're actually in the field where this all started in the spring of 2013. So over the next number of years, all the ground was converted away from ploughing to this type of system.
When I called into Andrew, the barley had been harvested and he was busy sowing cover crops into a stubble field for the winter. Buckwheat to suppress weeds and attract pollinators, radish to reverse compaction in the soil, and clover to restore nitrogen and reduce the need for chemical fertiliser.
I use about 60% of the synthetic nitrogen that I used to use. Compared to 10 years ago, my fungicide use is about halved. I don't use any insecticides. I've just made a decision that they were doing more harm than good. They're gone entirely. Herbicide usage is probably not that much down. Fungicide usage is considerably down.
Less fertilizer, less chemicals, and of big significance to his carbon emissions, no ploughing. Andrew employs a system called Mintill, which leaves the life in the soil less disturbed. But all of these changes came at a cost to his harvest yield in the early years.
You've got to average one year with another. It dropped slightly at the beginning and now it has probably levelled back to, on average, about where it was.
None of this, though, was without risk.
It's absolutely not without risk. And, I mean, I'm lucky. I'm of an age where my kids have been through college. My debts are largely repaid, so I can afford to take a few risks. Nearly all of my customers, and certainly the end users that my customers, if they're processors, sell to, they're all very much into the environment now, and they're all very much into carbon reduction, and a lot of them are talking to farmers about this and investing in programs. But what they need to do is take the risk out of it. Lots of farmers are interested and willing, and the body of knowledge is building, but it's a risk for an individual farmer in an individual year.
You have very generous hedgerows and borders, much more generous than I would be used to seeing in a tillage operation.
Windier. The margins came in as part of gloss, and gloss is gone and they're not going anywhere. Do you know, it'd be hard to measure what they take out of it, but there's fabulous habitat.
But these 12-foot high hedges and generous borders are only here by your goodwill now at this stage.
You're not being paid for them any longer. And yeah,
wouldn't it be nice if you were?
It would be a cracking idea if someone came in and said that's non-productive land, but it's doing the world a good for the environment. Why don't we give you a few quid for that?
So in principle, Andrew is all for using private capital to fund more environmentally friendly farming. But the commitment can't change with every business quarter.
One of the problems as a farmer is that, and it's not that their big corporations haven't been taking initiatives, it's that the farmer doesn't have very much say in these initiatives, and in my experience they tend to peter out. They start in a blaze of glory, there's a great big public launch and it's in somebody's field and he's standing somewhere that looks nice. But 2 years later, it's either changed radically, the personnel involved in it who were great and inspired you at the start have moved on, or the funding just dries up. So we need somebody between the little farmers and the big corporations to actually maybe to vet these schemes and to see that they've been run to a proper standard and that they're going to be properly funded and consistent.
Andrew Bergen there, just outside a thigh. Dr. Brendan Dudford is still with me talking about ReFarm. So, Brendan, in a nutshell, Andrew Bergen is saying, don't rely on goodwill. Farmers want to farm more sustainably, but they don't have the financial safety nets that they need to change from, for example, an intensive to a regenerative kind of farming. How is it that you and ReFarm are going to find ways to match that need for financial security with big businesses' need to offset its polluting?
I think that's a really good question, Philip. And just to say, like, Andrew's spot on, and it takes a farmer to express things like that, those complex issues, so succinctly. He participated also in two groundbreaking EIPs, Pollinators and Danu, but again, that funding discontinued. So he has a very strong point about the continuity of funding in public and these private schemes as well. So to answer your question, what we're going to do is... this thing is going to happen. This money is going to flow, and we want to make sure farmers who deliver for nature are positioned to benefit from it. But between now and then, there's a ton of work to be done to prepare the ground. So we're teaming up with Trinity Business School and Botany Department, some impact investors and people from the corporate world, to sort of figure out what are the pros and cons here, what are the banana skins, how does this money flow, what about accusations, if there's accusations around greenwashing and offsetting, things like that. To make sure we've got all those questions answered, and to make sure when that funding does come in, it comes in a way that suits the farmer on the ground. It doesn't suit the company, it suits the farmer on the ground. Because there's issues around monitoring and verification. And just one thing I think is important to say, like with acres last year, I think about 1.5 million hectares of land has now been scored. A value has been put on that land effectively, and companies must step up and support that, not at all to replace the public funding, but to add to it, to supplement and complement it.
When you mention monitoring and verification, that's at the heart of this, isn't it? Because offsetting has a bit of a dirty word ring to it, because very often the things that were being done when audited turned out to not actually lead to any biodiversity gain. Do you think that you can crack that particular problem?
I think we can, and I think this goes back to our time working in the barn, where we used very rapid assessments. So they're cheap and effective way of assessing the environmental health that the farmers are delivering year on year. Now, that scoring system has adopted and expanded by others. So we've 10 scorecards now, which have been widely applied, as I said, last year. So we have a really good, simple system that does work to capture what people are delivering. So I think if we proceed with something like that, and I'm not preempting how we'll do this, but that's one option. I think there's many others, but it's beyond my pay scale to judge how we do it. But I think it can be done, Philip.
Yeah.
And more importantly, it has to be done.
The problem that Andrew identified there about the targets and the objectives of private companies changing from quarter to quarter or from year to year is one that obviously your colleagues in Trinity Business School are going to tackle. But how is it that you think right now that you're going to be able to get people to commit over 20 or maybe even 30 year timelines?
I think it's going to be a challenge, obviously, and I think it will be public and private, a blend, as I said. But I do think what needs to be established is a fund, a funding mechanism through which these companies can invest and in return get reliable data showing what their impact has been. I do think there'll be a legal compulsion to do it. I do think there'll be an appetite to do it as well. And I do think in Ireland we're lucky. We do have a lot of companies at the moment who are prepared to invest in this, and I think that can be part of the future. But I would agree that it's not going to solve everything. There will be issues around flow and things like that, but we need to find better ways of assuring farmers a long-term return for their efforts in looking after nature, if and when they perform them. So again, it's a challenge, Philip, but that's why we're doing the research. Okay. And giving it a couple of years of a lead-in time.
And at the end of that few years lead-in time, do you think that we end up with something like a tradable nature credit, something that's generated on a farm for increasing pollinator, earthworm numbers, flower species, whatever, and then bought by industries that continue to discharge to water or to the atmosphere?
I'd like to think that would be not. I like to think it can be more and better than that. I don't want to be disingenuous, but I'm not preempting the research. That's what researchers are paid for, after all. But I just think we need to arrive at a place where farming for nature is seen as a sound business investment by farmers like Andrew, but also by businesses who will have to report on this in future. I don't like the term offsetting, and I don't think it should be about that. This should be about something where farmers are being paid for their work year in, year out to deliver nature on the ground. And how that's reported upon and the protocols surrounding it will have to make sure that companies aren't abusing that to continue to pollute. I think we all feel like that. That's just not the way forward.
Okay. Well, Dr. Brendan Dunford, we will have you and your colleagues in the botany department and the business department in Trinity in to talk about the detail as it is all worked out. But thank you very much for joining us this morning from Clare. Asking landowners to embrace any environmental initiative is, in a way, as you probably heard there from Andrew Bergen, also asking them to forget about the bitter experiences of previous schemes that went badly wrong. Miscanthus was one such idea from the noughties that burned many farmers badly. They took land out of crop and cereal production at the government's prompting to grow the elephant grass as a biofuel. But then, when plans changed, they were left with fields full of an unwanted 2.5 metre high energy crop that had to literally be dug out of it. It was an experience that turned many people off doing the right thing. But, as Hannah Quinn Mulligan found out when she visited the farm of James O'Keefe in County Meath, there are those who stuck with miscanthus and have carved out a new and very important role for it.
I mean, I never thought miscanthus... I kind of feel like I'm sort of... I should get a machete and, like, wade through. It's like, it feels a bit jungle-esque. Or something like that. It's so tall. I mean, how high is it?
You might see Tarzan coming there in a minute. Just watch out. I suppose it goes up to about 10 foot when it's fully mature. Yeah, this isn't just fully mature. It's probably about 9 foot, 8 foot, 9 foot. But yeah, it's an Asian grass. Some people think it's woody, but it's actually a grass. So Miscanthus sinensis is the proper name. But Miscanthus we call it, or some people call it elephant grass, and some people like to call it willow, and they call it whatever.
And why did you plant it the first day ever? Because it's obviously not native to Ireland.
No, there was a bit of a push by the government around 2006 kind of time to push it for energy generation, and they're going to burn it in the power plants, co-fire it with peat, Eden Dairy and places like this. But they incentivised farmers to plant it on what was set-aside ground at the time, which was an EU thing to not plant crops because they had too much cereals and storage in Europe. So in my father's time, in 2006, he planted it and they paid 50%, I think it was, establishment grant, so it kind of made sense. But the whole market never took off because the government forgot to incentivise the industry to use it, their own power plants like Bordenamona, Semi-State. So they just didn't bother. They tried, and it was a little complicated, and because they weren't being incentivised, they just didn't bother. And I suppose there wasn't as much of an environmental push at the time to decarbonise as there is today. In the life cycle of it, from growing right through to use, it's actually carbon negative. Like, people talk about carbon zero, but it's actually carbon negative. So it's like timber or wood. It'll sequester more carbon than it emits. So that's fantastic. And it can also be grown organically, which is fantastic. It doesn't need nitrogen. It doesn't need any sprays. There's no diseases or viruses that affect it in this part of the world. It fell out of favour, and most of it's gone now, ploughed up. We persevered and started selling it for horse wedding into the equine market in a kind of a small way, and it just developed and developed. And then I decided to plant more, specifically for animal bedding. So a lot of it goes for cattle now, but poultry is a big market as well. And it's going really well because it's, apart from being an alternative bedding, it's an exceptional bedding.
Hello. Hi, Colm. How are you? It's Hannah here.
Hello, Hannah. How are you?
I'm good. How are all the horses?
Great, thank you. Great. All in great form.
Colm Fitzpatrick keeps a number of high-level dressage and show jumping horses at his facility in Wicklow.
We would have a lot of high-performance horses here, and they're young at the moment, but there's one or two that we would certainly be setting our sights on, kind of top-level dressage. Even heading towards the next Olympics, or even possibly the one after that. So bedding is very important, particularly to do with the respiratory system. They're quite sensitive for such a big animal, and any dust or anything like that that gets into the respiratory system can do a lot of damage, and long-term damage that, you know, isn't so easily fixed. So one of the reasons for the switch was that the miscanthus is dust-free, and you're getting a high-quality product that's very competitively priced with shavings. There's really no difference between them.
I was going to say, because dust-free is obviously a big plus for you and for the horses, but it's not that much more expensive, is it?
It's actually, it works out the same. And even at times it can work out a little bit cheaper, because obviously there's no VAT on the miscanthus and you VAT on the shavings.
Oh, wow. And then I'm guessing an important question for you, with all the horses that you have, the mucking out, is it a bit better or is it the same?
The miscanthus we find to be far more absorbent. So in that way, we're taking out less bedding.
That's brilliant. Colm, thank you very much. I will let you get back to your horses.
Thanks a million.
Hannah talking to horse breeder Colm Fitzpatrick there. Still to come on the programme this morning, I have a special treat for you. Seamus O'Rourke, longtime friend of Countrywide, has a new book, and it is the funniest thing since Seamus O'Rourke's last book.
Email countrywide@rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
Now, a very big issue for GAA clubs and their survival is the changing demographics of the country. According to the latest CSO figures, 63% of the population now live in urban areas. So for rural clubs, that means fewer players. And for urban clubs, it's the opposite problem. Too many people, not enough facilities. At last year's GAA Special Congress, a motion was passed establishing new demographics committees across Ireland that are going to attempt to match facilities with population. To get an idea of what this mismatch looks like in real life, Brenda Donoghue went to Curla GAA Club in Cavan, which is at the sharp end of this problem. She talked to Benny Hurl, a man who believes that demographics is the single greatest threat to the GAA.
Right, boys, we're preparing for this match here now on Sunday, so we'll start off with our usual warm-up.
Brenda, this is just simply amazing. And like, when you drive past places like this and you look in and you see the facilities and you see the people out playing ball, like, this is the real GAA. This is where it's happened.
So, Benny, it's relatively new, but you are the chair of the National Demographics Committee for the GAA. Tell me a little bit about why such a committee was needed in the first place.
Well, for the best part of 50 years, people have been leaving rural Ireland. But three out of four clubs are situated in rural areas. But as a consequence of that, Brenda, a big part of the challenge for the GNO is actually accommodating those in the cities. When people talk about demographics, it's usually rural Ireland they're talking about. But the GAA has a particular issue now with what's going on in the towns. But here we are, we're in rural West Cavan, and look, all the best facilities, but they don't have the people. One of the things that we're going to have to look at is numbers. You know, so traditionally, GAA games, Gaelic games, are 15 a side. So, for example, in Corla, they're going to play a championship on Sunday. It's actually a junior shield. And they have had to get special permission from Cavan to play a 13 a side. So I'm talking to some of the lads here, and they're saying, look, you know, at a stretch, it will be 13 a side. They may have to get somebody out of England or some to come and make up 14 or 15. Numbers are a big issue in rural Ireland. Similarly, in urban centres, there are too many players, and they can't physically get games. There are not enough clubs, there are not enough teams, there are not enough pitches to play on. You know, participation rates in the cities are going through the floor because we don't have the facilities, and we don't have the pitches, and we don't have the clubs.
When we're looking at news about GAA, we're talking about moving championship dates and all these other issues. But you believe that this is the most critical issue for the GAA is demographics.
Yeah, when I stood up at Congress, I said demographics is the biggest threat to our association. In terms of scale, this is huge. You take from Donegal right down the whole of the Western Seaboard, right down to the Berry Peninsula. You've got many rural clubs, small clubs, struggling, unable to feed. Let's take South Kerry, for example. I think there's 11 clubs down there. I'm not sure if any of them are able to field independently. We're going to have to change our ideas. We need to come up with new thinking. The inevitable consequence of us doing nothing is going to be catastrophic. All of these clubs that currently are under pressure are going to be forced to amalgamate. You know, they're going to force go out of existence. Nobody wants that. Like the people here in Corla, they want to wear their own jersey. They don't really want to be amalgamated with another team. You know, so if, as a consequence of doing nothing, you know, so many clubs go out of existence and amalgamate, then the GAA overall is a weaker organisation, and that's not a good thing.
OK, pull all in together here now, right? Doing our stretches. Right, you come, Tony first.
Gerry Pryor, yes, the chair, how are you?
Very good, Brady. You're very welcome here to Corley Club.
Well, show me around. Tell me a little bit about it.
Let's go a little walk, right? See your club, right? We have our training pitch over there at the back. We have our stand. We have our lights there.
And there, you have floodlights.
We have floodlights,
yeah. You're underselling it, Gerry.
We have a grand walking track round the pitch as well.
Yeah.
There's a lighting facility round the walking track as well that if it gets come the dark end of it, then they can keep walking away. Yeah. The lights are on a timer here. They can stay up to 12 o'clock at night if they want to, you know. Come on over here with me now and I'll show you our dressing rooms. We have four dressing rooms, which is very, very important in a club nowadays with boys and girls and our outside toilets. We have two referees room as well. And you see this car park?
Yes.
We can put 120 cars into that car park, no problem. So we have a lot of facilities here to offer. And it's going to be very hard. What is going to be the end, you know, product of all this? Thinking ahead, it's not going to be easy for this club to field a team because the age profile... Too many going off the conveyor belt and not enough coming on it. That could mean that, well, we'll have to deviate maybe for 4 or 5 years. Another Croke Park rule and how long they can give us to see can we resurrect something. Realistically, we need 8 or 9 players in the next 12 months.
So for you, is it a possibility of amalgamating with your greatest rivals, the local neighbours?
It's very busy in the underage. We amalgamate with other clubs that they haven't enough either. And I said, I'm a long number of years with Derna Creeve. It was 2 clubs first, then it went to 3, now it's up at 4.
So you've amalgamated with 4 clubs?
With 4 clubs amalgamated together.
I'm just looking at your plaque here. And the facilities were opened by the great Mick O'Dwyer in 2009. How does it make you feel looking at these facilities thinking, well, there's no one using them?
Yeah. When I look at that there now and think of the crowd that we see at that time, that day, and the years before that and since that, I never thought it would come to this day, you know, that I'd be talking to you about this, that that our club is struggling to field a team. I get worried about it, afraid something is going to happen. It could happen that it could be closed down, you know.
Yes,
well done, well done. All right, boys, great session there tonight. As you know, it is Championship week. We need to prepare well. We'll go again Friday night. Everyone all right for Friday night at 8:30?
Yeah, great job, come on. Come on.
Friday night, it'll be all ball. The game is up in Killeshandra, 2 o'clock, Sunday. Everyone be known. I want to be the last person going into that dressing room at 1:15. We started last February in the dark. We want another round, and then we're going to finish in the dark. All right? Thanks very much to you, lads.
All right, great job, lads.
Good luck to both teams there. Curla and Killeshandra play tomorrow. That was Brenda Donoghue in Curla GAA in Cavan with the chair of the GAA's Demographics Committee, Benny Earl. Listening to all of that, old friend of Countrywide, a man who has just written a new book, Seamus O'Rourke. How are you?
Good morning, Philip.
Very familiar sounds to you there. That's just a couple of miles down the road.
That's just a couple of miles down the road. They're the greatest people on this earth, West Cavan. They're... great part of the world.
Enough miles down the road for the rivalry to be really intense or far enough away that you could be friends with them?
Oh, no. They're across the border. So club-wise, they're of no threat. Cavan as a county team would be a major threat. And so any time we ever played Cavan, we put in the boot.
How are you feeling about compliments at the moment? If I start handing them out, are you going to hope that the ground will just sort of open up and swallow you up?
It's not something we're used to down our way, but yeah, go have a stab.
The new book, Leaning on Gates, is the funniest thing I have read in ages. And you had me doing something every second or third page that I don't, generally speaking, ever do when I read a book. I was laughing out loud. And then, at the same time, two pages later, I'd have a moment.
Mm.
Because, oh my God, you lay on the poignancy, something rotten.
Yeah.
And yet, you were reluctant to write this book.
Yeah, I was. I think it's an extension of, the way I look at it now, it's an extension of my performance on stage, and that's the only way that I could get myself to write it with an audience in mind. I never thought of myself as an author, but I started to write plays because I wanted to perform, and I knew that unless I wrote them myself, I wasn't going to get a whole lot of work. So that's where the writing came in, and it was suggested many years ago that I might write a memoir, and I tried, and I got bored with my own story, and I left it there. And then I went back in 2020 with a new approach, which was to zoom in on tiny little details of my life and explore them, as opposed to
Of your youth, standing in gaps.
Yeah.
And so it was your reluctance in this one that you were dealing with, well, frankly, the awkward and the ugly years in any young man's life from 18 to mid-20s.
Yeah. Standing in Gaps was a nice book to write. It was very nostalgic and was talking about old times. This one, all of a sudden, and it wasn't until I started writing that I realised I'm going to have to deal with my bigger self. And it was quite painful at times. And I'm not saying that flippantly. It was because there's no point in writing it if you're not completely honest. So I had to do that, knowing that the whole country were going to realise what a neejit I was in my youth.
But anyway. I think the only man in the world who doesn't look back on that period of 18 to 25 and go, oh God, is probably running for election in America right now. You're very hard on yourself, but my God, are you funny. I mean, line after line after line. Me, full of the woes of being an overgrown 18-year-old, my youth had been one prolonged nappy rash. An uninflated spare tire of a fella like me. Yeah. You're very hard on yourself.
Well, I was encouraged. We were encouraged to use language like that. You know, we there was never too many compliments running around the house, and you know, I was told at a very young age that I had an ass's nose and all sorts of things. Never in any there was never any venom attached to it, but we used humour as a way of entertaining ourselves. But we also, it was also, we never made sure that we never lost the run of ourselves.
And the creative level of abuse coming from the sidelines of the pitch that you found yourselves on, my God, you'd want to be in fairly robust mental health to endure some of the stuff that was being thrown at you. Put your head where you wouldn't put your hand, young fella.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, the supporters long ago, of course, were not allowed to abuse players or refs anymore with verbally. But that time there was a great turn of phrase on the sideline, and it did affect. I mean, I was I got lots of abuse, and it didn't sit well with me. I mean, it's not the nicest thing in the world to be doing your best and someone fleece you out of it. And my I have a production company called Big Gorilla Productions, and that name came out of some fella shouting in. I was after hitting some young lad, and he was stretched out, and this fella shouts, "Put that big gorilla back in his cage."
Now, your self-flagellation is at the centre of the book, but so too are your parents. Who was in the house at that time between 18 and 25 during the period of this book?
Well, there was four kids altogether. My eldest sister Margaret had left the nest at this stage. So there was myself and my brother Kevin, who's the farmer, and then my younger sister Geraldine, and then my mother and father. And we were farming a small farm, and we were also moving into a new house, and
with all kinds of exotic luxuries like flushing toilets.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit strange to think of that now. It's hard to explain this to my kids that, you know, I was 17 and we still hadn't a flushing toilet at that stage, you know. And
I want you to set up a reading that you have done for us about when your parents go to the charity dance in the local hall.
Yeah. My parents didn't go out very often. We always had them at the fireside. My mother would always be knitting or trying to do something useful, and my father might read the paper for a very short time, but they were always working or around the house. So they never went out, never went to anything. But in this particular scene, they were at this charity dance in Carrigallen, and I happened to be at the same dance, and I have never been as embarrassed in all my life.
As we will hear now, this is Seamus reading from Leaning on Gates.
Saturday mornings were always different in our house, but this was the morning after Pat McKenna's social, and my parents were still soft in the cheeks from being out the night before. He had danced with my mother the night before, out of duty more than anything else. A surreal moment for me. I'm sure no one batted an eyelid, but I did. What were they thinking? The tallest of the tall in Carrigallen, dancing with a woman always claiming but never reaching 5'2". It was like he was wheeling a miniature statue of Our Lady around the floor. Surely they didn't have to do this in public. Mammy smiling the 1-2-3s while he went off with his head up, and from his belly button up it looked like he was dancing on his own. Of course it was only good manners to dance, seeing that it was a dance, but this wasn't my parents. My parents should know better than to do such an intimate thing in public. Their dance should have been limited to their everyday lives, from the jigs and reels of spring and summer to the slow waltzes of autumn and winter. In the kitchen, with their things in the yellow cabinet and the pull-down flap, the Rayburn range and the side tank, the high-up mirror where Daddy combed his hair and where Mammy couldn't see, the calendar with the cow's times and the Sacred Heart lamp on the wall. They could dance their dance in the scullery with the American washing machine and the coal press for the milk and the dinted buckets on the floor. They could dance by the green metal press over the sink with Daddy's shaving things, the veterinary supplies and the bags of blue, the penicillin, the teat dip and the caustic sticks for dehorning calves. Or by the buckets of drinking water for the house, cornered by the Corleen Wellingtons and the cat's meow. My parents could dance their dance in the byre and by the hayshed, in the ripples of the cow tracks across the fields. They could dance in the bog and in the meadow, saving the hay and digging the spuds, offending no one as they did. That was their way. They were not suited to stepping out in front of everyone at a parish social, but charity and duty had pulled this reluctant pair to the fore. And to me, a mixed-up brat of a boy at the time, they seemed to suffocate and dull in the smoking light.
Seamus O'Rourke from Leaning on Gates. The title is just absolutely perfect as a follow-up to Standing in Gaps, but you're not going to claim any credit for it.
No. I think there's about 10 different people suggested Leaning on Gates after they had read Standing in Gaps. So I tried very hard to come up with my own title, but I couldn't get anything as fitting as that. So the people are always right.
One of the important things in any book, obviously, is that our hero goes on something of a journey, and you go on quite a journey here, from a young fella who would have spontaneously combusted if he was asked to talk to a member of the opposite sex at the beginning of the book, to a young fella who manages to stand up three girls on the same night. Yes. By the time we're coming towards the close of the book. How did that come about?
I genuinely don't know. I got caught in the mix of rural pubs and drinking, and then a little taste of Dublin and a little bit of America for a while, and I got that terrible disease at one stage called confidence. Which did me no good. Thankfully, it's gone now.
You must have been a sort of a pleasant and agreeable young lad who just couldn't say no to
exactly,
a lady. You just had to say yes and then disappoint them.
Yeah, keep say yes to everything because we were always afraid that if you said no, you'd never get the chance again. So we grew up agreeing to everything and saying yes, and I said yes on many occasion, but then didn't have the maturity to follow through. That was my problem.
Well, and the other problem that you confront in the book here as well, on that particular night, you chose pints over any one of those three girls.
Yeah. This was one of the things that the book starts out when I'm turning 18, and at the time I didn't drink or smoke or do anything like that, and I was a teetotaler until I was 20. So you would imagine that I would have been mature enough to be able to handle the alcohol, but it wasn't. There was some calling to the town in our time. We were, my father used to say, "What is in this bloody town?" But it wasn't the alcohol. It was it was getting to the pub and the fun and the crack. And that time, rural pubs were thriving. You wouldn't if you went to the pub any later than 8 o'clock on a Friday or Saturday night, you wouldn't get a seat.
The pints and the crack, but oh my God, the style. And this the 1980s. Can you open your prayer book there, please, for me on page 195?
Yes.
I want you to actually read for me, please, about the style of it.
Oh, yeah. On Christmas night, I went to the Sportsman in Mohill to the disco. And because it was Christmas night, the bar didn't open till midnight. Fair enough. I didn't need drink. I was glowing enough from my recent sporting achievements. Women kept looking over. It was amazing. I stood with my back to the bar, 7-up in hand, and everyone was looking over. Yes, the women, but the men too. They couldn't help but admire the fine specimen that I was. I had my 501 jeans, I had big American runners and a polo neck black shirt. And to go with that, I had a white shoulder padded jacket with the buttons going diagonally across my chest. A bit of a George Michael look. I was loving the attention. I was weighing up my options. Stay where I was and avoid disappointment, which was never a bad option, or go for one of these chicks. There were no standout beauties, but they were all looking over. I turned around to the bar to gain more composure, and as I straightened myself, I could see this big wall clock above my head. That's what they were looking at, not me. Not my physique, not my mesmerising fashion sense. They were watching the clock creep towards midnight. They were waiting for the bar to open.
Ah, dear, wait for the bar to open. What I love about this Odyssey as well is that it takes, well, anybody of a certain age, over the age of 50, it'll take them back to places that they all were, particularly the bed sits of North Circular Road and places like that.
Yeah.
You can almost feel the fungus growing on you as soon as you walk in and
exactly.
open that chapter.
I went to Dublin, I think it was 1986, and it was so easy to get a bed sit at the time, 20 quid. It was a room with a bed in the corner and an electric cooker and a toilet somewhere else in the house. And I was only there a week, and there was three of us, three lads sharing this very small room. And the fungus had fairly had much better time than we had. I'll tell you that anyway.
I want to get one last clip in that you recorded for us, because the book Leaning on Gates finishes Leaning on Gates with your dad, and it's powerful stuff.
Some sons regret aspects of their relationship with their fathers. I don't. Some regret that they never hugged their fathers. I don't. Coming at my father with a hug would be like coming at him with a sledge. It would crush him and me. I loved my father, and I loved not loving him. And we had our moments of pure togetherness without the gloss of rubs and hugs and I love yous. And I also loved that sometimes he was my nemesis, my roadblock, my point of anger. Because when I was angry, it was always at myself. but he offered himself as a sacrificial lamb to be slaughtered by his own son for crimes uncommitted. Because if he was going to be hated, he wanted it to be by me. And in love and hate and all the gooseberries in between, we racked up a ton of strength and compromise. When he eventually heard one of my first recitations about a father-son relationship, subtly entitled, "What kind of an egot are you?" he passed it off saying, "Sure, only for me, he'd have nothing to write about. Rub it in, why don't you?" And the last thing he said to me 12 years later, as he was getting ready to die, he said, "You better go back and finish tiling that floor. No point leaving it half done." And I didn't hug him then either. And when I returned a few hours later, he was gone. My father and me were different. He was whole, and I was only half done. We had the same wiring, the same composition, and we both made things. But while I made things for show, he made things to last. My singing was loud, his was quiet and tuneful.
There is no man that will read that and not find a little bit of their own relationship with their dad in it. Fair play to you. The only outstanding question that I have for you is, when Netflix come to serialise this, who do you want to play you?
Paul
Mescal, my producer, is suggesting.
Oh, right, here. Okay. Yeah.
I think that Brendan Gleeson probably has a son somewhere who would be fitting.
Yeah, yeah. Paul Mescal probably is a much better footballer than I was in my prime, so maybe
you've three children, three grandchildren. Grandson's Fionn's 7th birthday.
Yes.
Today, isn't it? So we'll allow you to wish him happy birthday.
Yeah, so happy, big happy birthday to Fionn. Actually, it's next week, but okay. Yeah.
Leaning on Gates by Seamus O'Rourke, published by Gill. In bookshops now?
In bookshops now.
Excellent. And already the texts are coming in from the people who know that they're going to enjoy this one. Congratulations. Well done. On the countrywide team today, Amandine Paso-Devine stood in the gap. Harry Buckless leaned on the gate. Brenda Donoghue hurled dog's abuse from the sideline. Playback is up next with Fiona Kelly. Enjoy the ploughing if you're heading that way. And do visit the RTE tent, Block 3, Row 23. Thanks very much for listening this morning. Have a great weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.